That shortly we'll be joined by Michael, but in the meantime we wanted to get started. And first of all, I'd just like to say that I'm really happy that you've decided to attend or watch this seminar, as we're hoping that we can encourage as many people as possible to apply for professional membership. So many of you are, I think, very qualified, and we would like to expand our professional community. So we're going to be talking about some ways to do that, and hopefully this process will aid you in doing that. I want to say, of course, just in starting, that the Guild does offer various levels of membership, all of which are equally important and valued. But this particular process is for people who really want to be able to call themselves professional herbalists and who are wanting to align themselves with an organization that can help to enhance their practices, to grow them as practitioners, and provide a structure for interfacing and meeting lots of other wonderful professionals. I think a professional organization is something that we all really need. It is a way for us to grow ourselves as a community and as practitioners. Finally, I want to just say that we have a bit of history. I'm going to share a little bit of what Michael might have said, which is that this shared vision of the Herbalist Guild began in the mountains in Oregon, where a large group of professional herbalists from all parts of the nation gathered to teach, walk together in the ancient forest, to soak in hot springs, and discuss important issues to herbalism. Discussions at these retreats always included a vision of creating a guild. And now, after years of interfacing and talking and being together, the guild has really grown. And what we're hoping is to go on with our work. We really believe that we can help to contribute to the evolution of herbalism in this country and in the world as a whole. We hope that all herbalists, regardless of whether they're affiliated with us professionally or not, will work together with us as peers. All right, so we can go to the next slide. So yeah. Why do you want to apply? Well, first of all, you want to increase your professional credibility by identifying yourself as a professional AHG member or as a registered herbalist. I can say, as a teacher and as someone who has been involved professionally for years, that this can be a very important credential, especially for people who are wanting to find practitioners but are really uncertain about who's out there and what qualifies a person to be a competent herbalist.
If you just say next when you're ready, I'll just hit.
Thanks. All right, next. There. So this webinar is intended to serve as a guide for new applicants for coming years. And on the above areas, there are some of our distinguished members, KP, our president, Bevan Clare, Sheila Kingsbury, many other wonderful professional members are part of this guild, such as Christopher Hobbs, Aviva Rahm, Feather Jones, Phyllis Light, Susan Kramer, Nicholas Schnell, Patricia Carrizzi-Howell, Matthew Wood, Mimi Hernandez, David Winston, and many others. And also there's a growing number of qualified self-taught herbalists who are joining us. Many students who are graduating from herb schools and herbal training programs all around the country.
Michael, are you there?
Yes.
Welcome.
Hallelujah.
Not seeing the screen.
You're not?
Should I go to your screen?
I've got my screen showing because we went ahead and got started. She got the presentation to me so we could get going.
And I also don't see the attendee list. All right. So which slide are we on?
We're on the slide with the president and Bevan and so forth.
Okay, good.
Number two. I believe. No, three.
Yeah, number three.
Right. Very good. All right.
Okay, next.
Hi, everybody. I'm Michael Tierra. And I guess the time just got away from me a little bit here. And glad to be with you and through this, this important process of applying for professional membership to the American Herbalist Guild. Althea, did you do slide number three yet?
I actually did.
I thought you did. So we're on number four.
Yes.
All right. because you support and believe in the goals of the AHG, and
you want to honor diversity in herbal medicine, ranging from traditional indigenous models of herbalism to also modern clinical phytotherapy.
And we established the AHG professional membership as a recognizable standard of competency in botanical medicine.
To encourage the development of high standards of education that promote well-trained professional practitioners who offer high-quality herbal care.
Promoting ecological health and increase awareness of issues surrounding plant sustainability.
To strengthen the network of support and communication between herbal practitioners nationally and internationally.
And to foster high standards of ethics and integrity in the education and the practice of therapeutic herbalism.
We also wish to promote cooperation between herbal practitioners and other healthcare providers, integrating herbalism into community healthcare.
And to serve as a liaison to other professional associations and regulatory agencies.
Promote research in herbal medicine. Next slide.
The American Herbalist Guild Journal is one of the outstanding accomplishments of Aviva Rahm's presidency. And I believe that she may still be continuing as editor of this this important journal. It's the only journal, really, that I know of, I have to say, worldwide, that is about clinical herbalism. And there are other books and other periodicals that are printed about herbal science and like Herbal Grimm and so forth, and herbal history and different things like that. But actually, the actual Journal of the American Herbalist Guild is the only one that really is about clinical herbalism, which is what the American Herbalist Guild is about. Next slide.
You'll gain access to other benefits, including teleseminars. I'd like to say that there are many wonderful things on the website. There are all kinds of beautiful things in the archives. Of course, there are ongoing seminars, such as this one, but on a number of clinical subjects. These are all benefits that can really help you to stay current and to know what your fellow practitioners are thinking. Next slide.
Yeah, these webinars, by the way, are an important innovation of the recent board, and to really boost these up and to have more of them, and they're improving in quality all the time, I think, and of great relevance to anyone who's seriously interested in herbal medicine.
And next slide.
You will gain the satisfaction of knowing that you have attained the status of being a part of the North American Distinguished Community of Medical Herbalists. I can mention this because I think that my students particularly find a great value in this, and most people who have advanced themselves in herbal medicine find that a great value in becoming a part of the greater herbal community. I've always said that one of the best parts of being an herbalist is knowing other herbalists.
Yeah, I would have to second that. All right. Next slide. Oh, we're on it. Okay, the admissions committee.
Here we are, two of us. I've been on August, and Althea, I don't know if you're still on it now currently or not, Althea, but you've been on it for a long time, I know.
Yes, I have.
So basically, the admissions committee consists of five dedicated senior professional AHG members. And I say dedicated because it's no small thing to go through all of the applications that come to us and to try to evaluate the different applicants. We try our best to be as fair as possible, and to increase that possibility, that's why we're creating this webinar. So there's years of practical clinical experience represented by all of us. More than 100 years easily. Varied backgrounds, including some who are more interested in Western herbal medicine, eclectic medicine, TCM, Ayurveda, and even Native American traditions.
Next slide. I'd like to say go ahead.
No, you go.
We take our role pretty seriously, the five of us, and one of the things I think that's good about having such a diverse admissions committee is that no matter what viewpoint you come from, you're going to be well represented. And that allows for a real dialogue because we are looking to see the best in everyone, and we really want to be very fair. So we talk very deeply about these, especially often, people will send in an application and everybody just signs off on it. We know it's fine. But if we have questions, we really do think very carefully and look very carefully at every single application.
And we'll even meet on particular applicants and discuss them together. But initially, we each do these by ourselves so we can get our own personal impression before we speak to each other. Next slide.
How applicants are evaluated. So one of the things that each of us receive a copy of the application, as Michael was just saying, when we grade them, we send points. They're tallied at the office. And they're received by the admissions committee chair or the executive director. And what we do then is we combine everyone's grading and we create an overall score. And it's on the basis of that score that people are admitted. This is a volunteer process, so we ask you to be a little bit patient. We try to get them done in a timely fashion. Sometimes it takes a little longer, but we ask that you allow us 3 months to hear back from us. And one thing I want to stress is even if you feel like, certain questions are sort of maybe that might be from an angle that you're not familiar with, it doesn't really matter. And we really have tried to create a very broad process so that even though you might not have a high score with one particular question or even one small area, it really doesn't matter if you score well in others. So we are really looking to give you an opportunity to show where you shine. And we also understand that not everybody is going to be equally qualified in every single area. Next.
The criteria for professional membership. We have different parts of the application. Dealing with materia medica, therapeutic framework, practice management and ethics, basic sciences, academic and clinical experience. I don't know how much more is to be said about this because I think that as we go on with the presentation, each of these will be fleshed out more appropriately. Okay, next slide. Materia medica. We are requiring a working knowledge of at least 150 plants. Personally, I think that's a modest number of herbs to know to be a professional herbalist. We are looking at people who have an understanding of the traditional and historical uses, their therapeutic actions, their dosing and different forms of administration, their contraindications, possible herb-drug interactions, and any kind of basic understanding of phytochemistry relevant to therapeutics. Okay. I don't know.
One thing
the mute came on automatically. Did you hear all of that?
I did not.
About the materia medica?
Oh, no. It cut me off at some point.
Yeah, it just blanked out on me. Okay, so this is what we're asking, and this is what we are requiring when we talk about materia medica. So hopefully people who apply will understand at least 150 plants and all the different parameters of their use. Next slide.
Therapeutic framework. So what we're interested in here is that you have a theoretical foundation for developing herbal treatment protocols. And what we mean by this is we don't have one theoretical foundation. We do recognize that some people might come from Ayurvedic or they might come from TCM perspective. Others are coming from sort of the phytotherapy tradition using kind of Western clinical parameters, and you can work from any of those systems. But what we're interested in is that you do have a system, that you're not just, that you have a way of organizing your information. We want to see a demonstrated ability to conduct a comprehensive case intake and assessment upon which to build a protocol. So we're interested in, you know, how do you structure a case? What kinds of questions are important to you? What are the sorts of things that you ask? What are your assessment tools? And by this, of course, we mean things like, for example, if you're in one of the traditional systems, you might look at pulses or tongues. If you're doing phytotherapy, you might be looking at clinical laboratory parameters, blood work, things like blood pressures. But we want to know what your tools are and how you're thinking about things. So how you form a diagnosis and the rationale for the protocol that you choose. In other words, we aren't looking for a specific answer. We're really much more interested in how you arrived at your answer and whether or not that's something that makes rational sense. And we're looking for disease and constitutional analysis. So one of the things that is important to us is that you know, not be someone who just, sometimes people come in and they say, well, oh, I have high blood pressure. And then somebody just goes and says, oh, these are the herbs for high blood pressure. That would be the kind of thing that we don't like to see. What we would instead want you to be able to talk about is what you thought the underlying causes were, how you were going to design a protocol that would not only treat the person in the moment, but help to resolve the situation as a whole.
Yeah.
Next slide.
Wait a minute. I have a couple of comments to make here. First of all, many of us, matter of fact, I think just about all of us are teachers in our own right. And whenever one of our own students applies, we automatically exempt ourselves from voting. And so that the remaining members of the admissions committee are responsible for voting them in. And actually, in some cases, they might even go against the recommendation of one of the members who thinks that their student is qualified and based on the application, this is all we're really looking at, and that's why this webinar is so important. Based on how you present your application is ultimately how you're adjudged. The other thing about diagnosis is I don't think that Althea mentioned it specifically, but we're looking for differential diagnosis. In other words, if somebody came in and said and tried to make a complete diagnosis based on the pulse or the tongue, that would not fly as far as any of us are concerned. Not to mention, of course, if they came in and said, well, based on muscle testing or based on iridology, this is what we think, how we're going to prescribe and treat this individual. Differential diagnosis means that several different parameters are assessed described in the process of the cases that you're presenting. Thank you. Next slide. Next slide.
Practice management and ethics. This is important. You have to understand personal limitations and your scope of practice. It's also about the ability to refer to and consult with other health professionals and the demonstration of commitment to the ongoing botanical medicine education.
Yeah, and understanding personal limitations and scope of practice in my own particular work of over 40 years at this point, I think is really, really important. Most of us got into this thing thinking that some other herbs were going to be the be-all and end-all for all conditions that we encountered. And because we came in as mavericks, we felt that the Western Medical Association was against us. Well, I no longer feel quite that way. As a matter of fact, I think that complementary medicine and interaction with other health professionals is really important. And even if it's just a matter of conferring with other people in certain conditions, we owe it to our patients to be open to all of these possibilities.
Yes.
Thanks. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to add to that, too, that part of knowing personal limitations means that sometimes people come and they want us to treat very, very serious diseases. And That's not necessarily inappropriate, but it is inappropriate if you don't address the fact that that a person may need some other care. They may need to see a physician. They may need to see some other kinds of practitioner. And if you don't at least make that suggestion, I would say that's outside of our ethics.
And not only that, I think that there are certain conditions. First of all, as herbalists, we understand that we're treating the person with the disease rather than the disease the person has. So the focus is a little bit different, and it even involves legal issues as to how this is addressed. So while diseases are part of the presentation that people give us, the goal is really to improve the overall health of the individual. Next slide.
Basic sciences. These are just some suggestions. It doesn't mean that you have to be an expert in every single area here, but these are things that we think are important. Relevant and practical understanding of anatomy and physiology, plant chemistry, pathophysiology, whether through independent or formal education. And one of the things that I would say, again, is this can be self-taught. This can be you can go through a formal process of education. You just want to know that you have some knowledge in these areas. And again, something like plant chemistry, this is something that some people are very, very into, other people not so much. But at least it's significant, I would say, in understanding herb-drug interactions. Many practitioners learn in a variety of ways, and there they are, self-study, seminars, college classes, internships. So we're not necessarily rigid about how you do this. We're just interested that you have educated yourself.
Yeah, and I think it's important that that we understand that there are other systems and ways of explaining the disease and the health, underlying health of an individual, such as Ayurveda and traditional Chinese medicine expounds. And I personally think that if somebody's seriously interested as an herbalist, that there's no areas that they will not be expressed an interest in. They may not be this may not be a strong point, the basic sciences, but nevertheless, in today's world, I think it's something that we have to be open to and continually learning and evolving into. Next slide.
Academic and clinical experience. These are the two pieces that we would like to see. And there are different ways of achieving this. So there's a minimum of 4 years of combined academic training. This might be in a formal program. It also could be independent study plus some formal education. So it could be kind of a mix or match sort of thing. And certainly clinical experience. These are things that are required prior to application. Again, I want to just say we're not looking that everybody has to go to some sort of approved institution, but we do want to know how you have learned, and we need some documentation on that. We know that being a professional herbalist is an ongoing sort of thing. You're constantly educating yourself, and there are many, many ways that we do educate ourselves through reading, through taking seminars, through conferring with other herbalists, but definitely there is an educational process that needs to be ongoing.
Yeah, and we have to acknowledge the value of herbal certification that the AHG offers is very much involved in the standards that we're now trying to present and to emphasize. When I first began, and many of us first began, There was no academic training even possible in herbal medicine. But after being in it so long and doing it for so long, I'm sure we've exceeded any of the requirements that most any organization would expect of us. But now it's kind of the ironic change that we pioneers are now asking students to come up to a certain level. But it's for your own benefit and for the benefit of the profession that these standards are in place. Next. So here they are.
academic training. These are the basic things we'd like to see. So in about 200 hours here. And again, you can document all the different kinds of learning. It doesn't have to be in the form of a college course. But anatomy, physiology, certainly pathology, biochemistry, this one, I think some biochemistry is a good thing, medical terminology, and nutrition.
Good. Next slide. Academic training in nutrition, botany, and plant identification. These are all approximate, by the way, and because we grade on a point system, while you may have lower points in one area, you may have higher points in others. So it doesn't disqualify you if you don't think that you measure up in all of these areas as we're suggesting. But this is a guideline. Botany and plant identification, about 60 hours. Materia medica and therapeutic herbalism, 400 hours. The materia medica, in my mind, is basically what a mala is to a Buddhist monk, or the rosary is to a Catholic. It's something that we have to go through every day of our lives. It's a commitment. It's a spiritual practice to be constantly learning materia medica. Even an herb that we think we know very, very well, there are points that are constantly being understood and learned about it. So 400 hours is, to me, a very, very small entrance level. Pharmacy, pharmacognosy, and dispensing herbs, 80 hours. Clinical skills, 400 hours. These are all very minimal, in my opinion. Career preparation, practice development, and ethics, 20 hours. History, philosophy, introduction to research, 40 hours. Next slide. Where are we at? Clinical requirements. A minimum of 2 years of clinical experience through independent practice, formal mentorship, or supervised clinical training as part of an academic program, or a combination of the above. This should total at least 400 hours with at least 100 different clients during this period. This is a difficult point for many schools and many herbalists to fulfill, and we're certainly open to trying to consider all the possible ways that a student who otherwise looks very, very qualified can accomplish these requirements, but it still is, in our opinion, a minimal amount of requirement in terms of the hours and the time spent with patients. But the biggest problem, I think, is herbalists being able to try to find ways to have patients. First of all, I think as we mentioned earlier, you should document every single person you've seen from the very first day, at least in theory, that you begin herbal studies. Write down what you saw them for and what you did and results that you had. All of that can be time that can be added up. And the other thing is to find venues and areas where you can see patients. For instance, working in homeless shelters or in farmers markets or various ways that you can volunteer your skills and so forth. Working with a mentor, this can be done on the telephone, it can be done in person. We think that it's very important that if you've undergone a particular kind of training, say if it's in Chinese medicine or it's in Ayurveda or it's in combination of all three, which is what I teach, planetary herbology, then I think that it's ideal that you choose a mentor who is familiar with that training so they can guide you further into the process. Next slide.
Okay, so this gets us to the actual application. And you're going to begin by you sending us a query. You can call us or email to the AHG executive director. And by the way, Tracy is very helpful in guiding people through the process. And if you have questions or you're kind of wondering whether or not you're ready, he's a really good person to speak with. And you'll be assisted in the application process, including the requirements and all the different documents that you need to assemble. And when you do actually put your application together, we ask, you know, that you be as succinct but thorough as possible in your application, because actually, since we are a volunteer committee, we don't want to be reading 300-page documents. On the other hand, we really want you to take the time to show us who you are and the quality of your work. Next.
Training programs you've attended, completion dates, and the names of your primary instructors. Most of us are pretty connected in the herbal world, so we know a lot of other herbalists. So this is a good place to drop names if you have any. But we also know that we don't know everybody, but we want to know who you've been working with. The documentation for 400 hours of clinical experience, degrees, diplomas, and/or licenses that you may have. You can submit photocopies of these along with your application. We don't necessarily go through and check the documentation that you have actually done 400 clinical hours, but we reserve the right to be able to ask that if we need to confirm and to verify the information that you're submitting to us. Next.
Your practice. How long have you been in practice? And there again, some of you may have not been in practice, but you have been had 400 hours of actual supervision in a program. That counts. So, but if you've been in practice, we really want to know how long you've been in practice. We would like to know any areas of specialization that you might have. So, for example, we have had some applicants that are very, very specialized. Like we had one recently who was dealing with in the addictions field. Other people might choose to specialize in women's medicine or autoimmune diseases, something like that. And we really want to know who have been your mentors, supervisors, teachers, people that you consult with. It's great if they're AHT professional members because then, of course, we know them. But let us know regardless because we're interested. And we also want to know any internships or supervised activities such as apprenticeships or case review groups, things like that. And I just want to add here, this is a little bit from the last slide as well, when you're submitting any workshops or programs you've done, you know, give us the really good stuff, the juiciest stuff, but you don't have to list every little thing you've done in your 20 years or whatever of study. Oh, and also, let us know if you've been writing or presenting. That's really good stuff, too.
Yeah, we don't get paid by the hour doing this.
Right.
We don't get paid at all.
All right, next slide.
The number of clients you've seen. Again, this is an approximation, but I always tell all of my students and anyone who's interested in herbal medicine that and wanting to ultimately become professional to keep records. So what is currently a typical caseload in your practice? How many new patients do you see on a regular basis, and how many are return visits? I hope that if you're seeing people, you do see some return visits. I personally think that's an incredibly important. I know in my practice, if I give somebody an herbal treatment, I want to see them in a week because I expect if I'm giving them the herbs, it's going to do something to them, and I want to know what it's doing and so that I can adjust it accordingly. If you have not started practice yet but have 400 hours of clinical supervised practice in a student clinic, for example, then you are qualified, so you should apply. And if you have 400 hours of mentor practice, you are also qualified based on that. So we would like to see a letter from your mentor saying that they helped you through this process for 400 hours, and they think you're ready to fly solo for a while and do your own thing. Next.
Methods of practice. This is where we really want to learn about how you work. So we want to know how long you typically spend with the patient and what is your intake process. So what are the kinds of questions that you ask? And we want to know if you ask questions about the entire history of the client, meaning, you know, from birth onward, or are you just doing an intake on sort of in the moment, whatever their presenting symptom is. I like to see a full history. We want to know whether you ask questions about lifestyle or other things, exercise, diet. What are the things that you think are significant? We also want to know whether or not you work from an energetic or a scientific model. And we don't have a bias. We just like to know that you are working from a model. We also want to know if you've utilized lab results, what ones, and pulse diagnosis, tongue diagnosis, any form of physical assessments. That's all, you know, grist for the mill. And it's not so much that, you know, we don't necessarily think that you have to spend hours and hours with a patient, but we do like to know that you've given a thorough evaluation and you're looking not just at presenting symptoms, but also at constitutional aspect of what's going on.
Yeah, we never asked for it before, but if you have an intake form, for instance, that you're using, it might not be a bad idea to include that with your application.
Yes.
What you're covering. Again, we want to emphasize differential diagnosis. I can't emphasize that enough because some people think I'm against iridology, which I did for many years, or I'm against kinesiology. Well, I don't use those anymore. I don't find them to be useful in my own personal experience. But I also think that there are many people who would find them to be an important part of a complete differential assessment. So if you're basing your entire assessment of someone on any one parameter, even if it's only lab tests, you're gonna be knocked down for that. So be sure that you're understanding that you need to be able to show an ability to assess a patient from different parameters and have a balanced approach in that way. Next slide.
With whom do you consult when needed? We'd like to see variety here. So in other words, I'm not too happy if the persons you consult with are all medical doctors or are all herbalists or all anything. I'd like to see variety because typically, at least in my own clinical practice, there are often people come in and sometimes you really do need a medical consult or sometimes you would like them to see a chiropractor or some other kind of specialized person. So it's nice to see some breadth in there. We also want to know if you have relationships with mainstream practitioners as well as alternative practitioners. To me, I think that's important. I'd like to see at least one mainstream practitioner in there.
Yeah, and I have to point out here that it's to your advantage that all five members of the admissions committee don't necessarily agree on all the things that they're individually looking for. And in this case, for instance, I particularly would like to see at least one medical doctor as part of the people who a serious herbalist is consulting with. One of the other members of the committee says that medical doctors in certain parts of the country are not so easy to come by and having such a standard may not be realistic. Well, I'm flexible about that. But I also know that if we're really thinking about the best, the well-being of a patient, we try to go outside of our own particular expertise to get assistance from other areas, and to ignore Western medicine at this particular time in history, I think, is a big mistake. Next. And your work experience in the herbal field. A professional herbalist is may not just be somebody who sees people clinically, although this is what the AHG is about. But we understand that herbalism, as the AHG represents it, has many different facets: teaching, growing herbs, making preparations, all kinds of things that we all kind of various times find to be really fun to involve ourselves with. So, and a lot of us have had opportunities working in stores, and oftentimes it's a good place to really get a good idea of what herbs are working for what, and so forth. So we want to know how resourceful you are in finding ways of working in the field as a volunteer, networking with other people, and so forth. Next slide. Contributions you can make to the AHG. I can't say how important this is. So many people, as Kennedy says, you ask not what you can receive from your country, but what you can give. So many people join organizations just to be able to hang a shingle on the wall or something of that, or hang a document on the wall. We hope that the applicants who come to us, while that's an advantage for being able to say that you're a professional member, understand that an organization is as good as its members are in contributing to it. And we're looking that if we're applicants, especially who are willing to find ways that they can participate, whether it's a volunteer position on the board or working on committees, which are expanding more and more, so that there's always something to do. This is just basically an umbrella for us, all of us herbalists from all over the country, to join forces and work to really create a great legacy in terms of herbal medicine. Next slide.
Legal or ethical disputes. So if you've had any difficulties legally or had any accusations leveled against you, please take the time to explain what happened, how the matter was resolved, and whatever else you feel we need to know. So this doesn't mean that if you've had a run-in legally that it in any way disqualifies you. Certainly in a profession such as ours that is still struggling to be recognized, things can happen. People can come after you. But we have to also, as a professional organization, if you have been involved legally, we do need to know. If nothing else, it's a chance for you to voice, you know, what has happened and perhaps get some support around it. But we also need to make sure that we do examine this issue with any applicant.
Yeah, I don't know if it's still in place or not, but at least a few years ago, the AHG was able to secure the possibility for professional herbalists to purchase malpractice insurance. Not a bad idea. Healing is always involves a certain amount of risk, and it also involves a certain amount of courage. And I understand that after having done it so long, and things happen in practice. I guess I can tell a personal anecdote about this. I was once sued for $3 million. This was at a time when I was lucky if I had $100 in my pocket, and it was basically a patient who had problems with during childbirth because she claimed that I had recommended a midwife to her, and because of a deep pocket situation, the lawyer included both myself and the midwife as part of the lawsuit. And I had no malpractice insurance at the time, but I was had a very smart lawyer who was able to get my homeowner's insurance at the time to back me up on that one. And I was entertained for a whole month going to a trial where both of us were, the midwife and myself, were being tried at the same time. The outcome of that was that I was completely exonerated of any wrongdoing. The insurance companies were very keen on it because it meant that if you went to a gas station attendant, he said you should go down the street and buy your glasses there or get some other service somewhere else, and you went and did that and you had a bad experience, that you could go back to the original person and the gas station attendant and sue him because he mentioned that individual to you. And I didn't realize at the time it was a cause celeb for all the insurance companies in the country. They were definitely wanting me to win, and they put a lot of money into being sure that I won. I mean, unbelievable amounts of money. So these kinds of things happen, and to me, I feel it's a richness in my experience that I can share with people. And it's really nice to know. At the time, there was no American Herbalist Guild, but it's really good to know that there's an organization that you could turn to and get emotional support, if nothing else, and possibly, you know, being able to talk to someone like myself and give you some ideas about how you handle these situations. So ethical and legal disputes will be an issue as time goes on, and we would like to know if any of these have occurred to you and whether it's something that we can help you with. And again, it's nothing none of this necessarily means that you automatically disqualify from professional membership. Next slide. Why do you want to join? We're always interested in this question because it helps us to build an organization. Matter of fact, I've been asking it to my students, and we've been just kind of getting a feeling of why is it that somebody would want to become a professional certified American Herbalist Guild herbalist. So we're asking that you take the time to let us know what you feel is the main role of this organization and how you would like us to carry it out. This is your organization as a member, and the organization is not here to burden you, but to actually help to support you in the things that you're interested in. And we're interested in clinical medical herbalism. Next slide.
Your reference books. So we're going to ask you to list your reference books. We really want to see the books that you are most likely to use in your practice. One of the things I just want to say here is I'd like to see some serious books here. So, you know, it's fine to have a couple general herbals because, you know, even after 30 years, believe it or not, I still run back and look stuff up all the time. So it's good to have general things. So, for example, if you were in Chinese herbs, you would probably have Bensky and Connor. I mean, like, it's just everybody looked at that book. But we also are really interested in some more weighty books, and I'm always curious about, it tells me a lot about an applicant in terms of what it is that they're actually interested in. So sometimes, you know, it could be a kind of a specialized kind of text that's on a given area, like might be, you know, herbal medicine for autoimmune diseases or something. I'm always interested in that. And it's also, I'd love to see, it's certainly not a requirement, but I'm always happy when I see something that has works from a historical perspective, like the eclectic physicians or other traditional sources. If you look that kind of stuff up frequently, that's kind of nice to know. So we're not really asking you to, you know, to try to create like the perfect list or anything like that. And I will hope that you actually will let us know what it is that you are referencing, because that can be really helpful information. But we would like you to have some sort of breadth in what you give us.
Yeah, I would comment on that for me, the importance of a clinical manual is what I'm looking for all the time. A lot of people will mention their favorite book, and in other words, a book that you like. But when I have almost every herbal that's been published in the last, you know, 30, 40 years, and when I look at that, I say to myself, well, you know, that's a nice book, and maybe I learned something from it, but can I take it into a clinic and use it as a reference for looking up this person and what I need to be looking for with this person as these conditions and so forth? Those are the kinds of books we're looking for. Interestingly enough, it's an area that is still sorely lacking in Western herbal medicine, and even in Ayurveda for that matter. A clinical manual in Ayurveda, there's only one I think that I would see as a clinical manual that could be used. Ayurveda in Nepal, for instance, by Alan Tillotson and Todd Calvicut, based on the actual practice of a Nepalese Ayurvedic doctor and what he actually does for different conditions. Other than that, there's like a plethora of books that are kind of historical and informational and so forth, but to actually take into a clinic, I use a number of different Chinese clinical manuals. As Althea pointed out, I think the richest source that Western herbalists have to rely upon are the eclectic tradition. And fortunately, most of these books are all available online. So if you told me, for instance, that you were using King's American Dispensatory or Felter's book eclectic doctor, I would see that as a very good clinical manual to use. On the other hand, there are another number of other books that are informational, like The Honest Herbal by Pharaoh Tyler, and maybe you like that book, and you know, it's a good book. but it's not a book that I would take into the clinic when I'm trying to see a patient. So those are the kinds of things that I'm personally looking for, and maybe some of the other members of the admissions committee might have a little bit of a different perspective on that, but that's just my personal bias. Next slide. What journals do you read? We want to know that you're trying to keep up with all the different changes and evolution of herbal medicine. I just remember, 1969, 1970, going to see Dr. Christopher, an herbal journal, an herbal magazine, it was unheard of. And increasingly, there are some really outstanding books like the Townsend Journal and Herbalgram and so forth that offer a lot of, and of course the ASG Journal, that offer a lot of useful information. And so we think that it's really important if you're a serious and dedicated herbalist that you are keeping up with some of the latest evolution in herbal medicine today. Next slide.
So, personal statement. Some typical thoughts might include letting us know your views on the role of herbal medicine in the modern world. Do you see it as a complementary medicine or as a standalone medicine? Are you someone who thinks that we should work to interface with mainstream or strictly stand off by ourselves? What do you think comprises real healing? And what is the role of the practitioner vis-a-vis the patient? This is, for me, a really important one. I really am very interested in knowing how you view that. So some practitioners view themselves sort of as the kind of the authority who's going to, guide their patient. Others view themselves more as educators. Some other people will view themselves as being a companion, in a sense, to a person in how they're going forward in life. But whatever your particular viewpoint is, include some ideas that give us a sense of who you are as a healer.
Yeah, and remember, you only get a few points for this. So I think that it's important to keep it in perspective. One could write a whole book on your personal views on healing and your role in it. But I think being succinct and to the point, we'll get where you're coming from, and that would help us. Thanks. Next slide. Your letters of reference. Letters from practitioners of the medical arts that are also familiar with herbal medicine. In other words, know herbal medicine. Maybe practitioners of orthodox or alternative medicines. A letter from one or more of your teachers is preferred. Letters from colleagues, letters from other American herbalist certified professional herbalists. All of these are people who we know, and that helps a great deal in these letters. But sometimes people will find a letter from a nurse or something, or just somebody down the street who might know chiropractic, doesn't know beans about herbs, and a letter of reference saying that you're a good guy or a good girl or so forth isn't helpful here. We want to know that somebody else who we can respect respects your accomplishments. Next one.
The clinical protocol section. So this is where we're going to give you five theoretical questions. These are short, and they're usually based on actual cases. But there's not enough information for a definitive answer. So you don't have to worry like, oh, do I have absolutely the right answer? Because often if you look at this case, you'll be thinking to yourself, accurately I might add, well, could be this or could be that. What we want is to know how you're thinking about it. So you would say, well, you're going to provide your answers based on a provisional basis. So you might say, well, if this case is, is based on this particular disease process, or then this is what I would do, and here's why. and these are the herbs that I would be using. And so more or less, what we're looking for here is not that like there's some absolute right answer, but we want to see whether or not you have an ability to analyze a case, to come up with a sensible scenario, and to create a rational protocol. That's pretty much what we really want to do. So, and I might not even always agree sometimes with what people say, but as long as it makes sense within the context of their system, that's an acceptable answer.
That's very good. Next slide. Okay, the clinical protocol section. We grade on a point system based on our evaluation of your assessment and differential skills, etiological understanding. In other words, how did the condition develop? How such a condition happens, etc. Possible effective rational treatment protocols. We are also evaluating your understanding of potential risks, herb-drug interactions, and scope of practice. So you can expect that there may be a couple of little things obvious to anybody who's a serious herbalist, tricks in these questions that we expect you to point out, and risks and so forth that may be involved and so forth. And that you're not, in other words, you're not just being cavalier about, oh, I can treat congestive heart failure, it's simple, and here's what I do, I get them Hawthorne and that's the end of it. No, that would not work for us at all. So anyway, I think that's about all that we have to say there on clinical protocol, but this is one of the most tricky and questions, I think, on the application, and one that I think that is we're going to show a sample, a successful application later on in this presentation, where you get an idea of how one applicant handled it. Okay, next one, Materia Medica. Okay, this is the herbalist's Bible, knowing your herbs. We give five herbs, and we ask that you tell us what you know about each, how you use them in practice, in formulations, and what contraindications, adverse reactions, and interactions are possible. We expect that even if in practice there is no evidence of a negative reaction reported, that you are at least aware of the possibility.
Who would you and would you not give a particular herb to? We prefer that you do this on the honor system without reference to tests. However, we have become quite good at sleuthing out when somebody's really quoting from a text, so I'll just throw that in there. Anyway, the other thing I want to say is I think the thing that we're most interested in really is you can recite whatever's in this volume or that, but we really are just interested in how do you use that particular herb. So you may have a particular take on an herb, and we'd like to know what that is.
Absolutely. That's the most important thing, how and under what circumstances you would use a particular herb. After you've covered the basics about the contraindications and all that kind of stuff that we're looking that you know and that's readily available, the part that is hard to fake is how and under what circumstances you would or would not use a particular herb. So I hope you include that in your application. Next slide. Your case studies. This is the fourth part of the application, and it is very important. I believe we're asking for three case studies to be presented, and I suggest that you choose the most interesting ones, not necessarily how you treated successfully or not somebody's common cold. Something a little more interesting and juicy than that. We're less interested in whether you actually cured anyone. We certainly realize that not everybody's going to be cured, even under the best practitioner available. There are certain conditions that may not be curable, but everyone can be benefited by an herbalist consultation. And so, the outcome doesn't always have to be positive. It just needs to show that each time you saw this person, that you were following a rational and a reasonable treatment plan. It should be a practical demonstration of how you apply all the things that you learned based on the three criteria as in Section 2 on clinical protocols.
We want your case studies to be succinct, but complete. So one of the problems that sometimes happens is people will give a case study, but they don't give a lot of information about, they'll just say, it's this or that, and I gave them these herbs. But I don't know how they arrived at the this or that. I don't know what sort of things they were thinking, whether they were looking at tests, whether they were doing physical assessments. You know, we really need to know how you arrived at your particular diagnosis. And then we also, it's helpful to know why you chose the herbs that you chose. So I don't need a dissertation, but if you decided to use hawthorn and chasteberry, I want to know why. What was your intention when you chose those two herbs? Next
one, we're finally at the place where we're talking about presenting an example of a successful application. We're not going to go through the entire application because I think it would make the whole process very lengthy. Hopefully, this webinar is going to be recorded and it's going to be available for you to look at the application in more detail. But we want to touch on a few particular issues. And
Michael, before you go over sample application, there are a few questions that have been asked that maybe you could give a little clarification to for some people who were asking. Someone was asking about, the requirements for the supervised clinical training, and they live in a rural area, how do they, get supervised training? But I think you kind of said that it doesn't necessarily have to be supervised. If they've just been doing this themselves for a number of years, they just need to document that they've been doing that, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Also, however, if they're in a rural area, Stephen, they can get a mentor through the AHG. This is somebody that will look at cases, and this is particularly good if you're a student. I mean, if you've been working for 30 years, okay, but if you're new, then I would say get a mentor. Get somebody who can review your cases once a month and sign off on them.
Okay. Also was asked, is a diploma sufficient proof of hours for academic training, or do you want a syllabus of what was in the class?
A transcript would be nice. It's not required, but it's nice. If somebody has a diploma, they probably have a transcript.
Yeah, so the transcript would be welcome. Someone asked, if you do you have to submit information about all 100 clients, or do you just kind of a summary that you've done a certain amount?
A summary.
Summary.
Yeah, we would not want to see 100 clients.
I don't want anybody to submit 100 clients. You're gonna find a very fatigued admissions.
Shoot me now.
We want to know that you have that information, and if we have any further need to look at any of your clients, in other words, you're claiming you're seeing so many people in the last 2 years, we might ask you, well, who did you see in July or February, for instance, send us. We don't want to know their names. We just like to know who you saw and what kind of conditions you treated and so forth.
Okay. There was a question about a time limit on coursework. It doesn't matter when they did the coursework, right? Whether it's 5 years ago or 6 years ago or
it doesn't, because while we're very eager and interested in schools and training programs to adopt at least the basic educational guidelines that the AHG has set forth, it's not necessary that a student follow a course that includes all that in any one place. So basically, you can learn from different sources.
Yeah, so like they said, can they include workshops that were led by trained herbalists like Christopher Hobbs or Susan Weed or whatever? Okay.
Absolutely. I would also include that there might be there are many companies now that conduct some pretty impressive seminars. And I would certainly consider those as well as education.
Yeah. A specific question was that someone says because finding clinical supervision is difficult, they have started a program where they have a mentor, a client, and several students. Would a student participating in that for 400 hours be sufficient to count for the 400 hours of trained?
We would certainly, let me just back up. We would certainly take that under consideration, and definitely they would be given credit. Whether all 400 hours, the question I would have personally is, did this student do any of the intakes? I mean, doing an intake it takes practice. And so I would like to know that they were at least doing some of the intakes as opposed to simply observing.
Okay. And then someone said, with whom do you consult? Is that also mean that who do you refer to?
It could be.
Okay. Could be.
It might be, or it might even just be that you sometimes call somebody up and say, look, can I run this by you because you think this is something, or maybe I should recommend that they get, you know, further work up.
And would you consider a licensed naturopathic doctor to be a mainstream medical contact?
Depends on the state, but yes, I would.
Yeah, a licensed, you mean the Pacific Northwest graduates, yes. But keep in mind that there are naturopathic programs all over the country, and people who claim that they have degrees and so forth and all of that. I'm not disputing the value of that, but I just as a matter of course, I would question and want to know more about anyone like that.
Someone asked about documenting education where their mentors are deceased.
Oh, boy. Well, you know, that's one of those things where if they made a great application and their mentor was deceased, I'd probably go, what the heck, you know? Because you can tell a lot just by how people answer questions.
I'm glad these questions are being answered because I think it really points up something that we're trying to get across here, which is that what we're offering here are not necessarily rules, but guidelines. And if you don't necessarily get a maximum number of points for one particular thing, if somebody said their mentor was deceased, maybe instead of giving them 5 points, I'll give them 3. However, on some of the other ones, you're getting more than enough points to compensate for that. So keep in mind that there's no one of these criteria that we're basing everything on.
Okay, just a couple more. Someone asked, do you recommend a professional AHG membership for someone who is not primarily a clinical practitioner, but is more of a medicine maker, teacher, presenter, or so forth? Do you think that they should still benefit by trying to become a professional member?
Yes.
Maybe.
We might not agree on that one, huh, Michael?
Yeah.
But I think so because it's credibility. I mean, even if you choose, let me say this. So if you have the knowledge, but you choose not to practice as a clinician, instead you choose to be a teacher, and there are a lot of us out there are doing that, or you're a medicine maker, still, it's an important credential. It shows that you have the knowledge to be a clinician.
Yeah, that's important, but keep in mind that the very act of applying, you're applying based on your own clinical practice. So you can't apply based on the fact that you've made medicines or you've taught classes. I mean, you can't fulfill all the questions that we're trying to ask you. So that's important to keep that in mind.
I think on that question is if the person is willing to do the clinical work and everything, then obviously, being a professional member is going to enhance their credibility as a teacher as well if they go through the process, yes. And then someone asked about that they work primarily with animals and wanted to know about that.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know.
say about that is that I wouldn't be qualified. I wouldn't be qualified to even look at that because the needs of animals are radically different from humans. And in some cases, herbs that are quite benign among humans will kill animals.
What I suggest that person does, because I know there are some other really good herbal veterinarians in the guild, is they get together and actually develop a program for that. Right now, we don't have it. We're basically based on treating human beings. But I think this would be an enterprising branch for the PhD to expand into.
Well, right. And also I might add that if somebody did apply on that basis and they had the background, we could probably find somebody who would be qualified to look at that kind of application.
Yeah. There's a couple of questions surround a general thing about, you know, documenting independent study. And I would guess that what you just want is for them to at least list it or give some, you know, thing that they've studied these particular books or these particular courses or whatever, even though they don't have certificates or whatever. You would still want them to do that, right? Okay.
Yes.
All right. That takes care of all the questions pertinent to the application, so let's go ahead and get back to the presentation.
If you skip to slide 56, Stephen, hopefully the entire webinar will be posted. But this, basically what this is a student who applied, and we thought this was a really good applicant, and they passed with flying colors. And we wanted to point out and show some of the things that they did. So this was a clinical protocol, one of five examples. And a pregnant woman, age 28, in her second trimester, mother of two children, ages 5 and 7. She presents with periodic vaginal burning and itching, which is worse upon urination. And she also complains of chronic nasal stuffiness, mild emotional irritability, and mood swings. Urinalysis reveals a mild elevation in leukocytes with a slight alkaline pH, but is otherwise normal. The patient craves bread and eats some form of pasta or bread. So this is how this student dealt with this. She said, what would she do with such a person? She'd ask the following questions. Go ahead, Althea.
I think I'm just looking at the slide. We need to be at slide 56, I believe.
Yeah, we were. I just finished slide 56. Now we're on 57.
Oh, it's not showing on mine.
And I'm passing the ball to you. But I can do it if you want.
Yeah, go ahead, because I can't. It's not coming on my screen. I'm on part one, number of years.
Part one, number of years. Okay. See if you can find it. Okay. Anyway, since this was my student, I guess I could talk a little bit more about her. So she says, I would ask the following questions. How often is periodic, and is she aware of anything else prior to the occurrence? Is she sexually active? Did she experience this while previously pregnant 2 times? Discuss personal hygiene with her. Present, check tongue and pulses. Review diet and food cravings. Any GI issues? All of this is showing clinical protocol, which is what we were very interested in. We were satisfied in seeing how she's proceeding with this based on her replies here. She would say in slide 58, this is the client's third pregnancy, which may make her more susceptible to urinary tract infections due to the possibility of prolapsed organs. That's one possibility. Her diet and food cravings indicate a high intake of sugar from which bacteria and yeast feed and grow and has weakened her spleen qi. So obviously she knows a little bit about Chinese medicine, with the dampening rising up to the lung area and then to the nasal passages. Her cravings and consumption of bread and pasta 3 times a day are extremely high glycemic, not readily digestible, and will heat the blood. And slide 59, the hormonal changes experienced during pregnancy will also affect her liver qi, as demonstrated by her mild emotional irritability and mood swings. The high sugar diet will trigger more reactions. She also has the added stress of taking care of two small children. Again, we're seeing this patient, this applicant, and how they are applying their own clinical protocols. One of five examples are of how to respond to all of these is dietary changes, reduce or preferably remove all the processed starches from the diet, increase the consumption of green vegetables substantially, advise water consumption, 68 cups a day, reduce, remove greasy, oily, fatty foods from the diet, lean animal proteins, grass-fed, certified, organic with fibers, veggies in a soup, small amount of rice cooked in a watery base with the green veggies, have her OBGYN check her blood for gestational diabetes, advise or warn her that alcohol consumption is contraindicated at all times in pregnancy. Hygiene, clean the area from front to back after going to the bathroom, clean the area from front to back before and after sexual intercourse, wear cotton materials, stay away from synthetic materials, use soaps that are non-perfumed and free of dyes, and wear loose-fitting garments. These are possible traditional and medical diagnoses. From a traditional Chinese medical perspective, it would be described as damp heat and the lower warmer being the pelvic cavity. From a Western perspective, it could be Candida albicans or some other kind of vaginal infection. From an Ayurvedic derangement, it could be pitta, which is heat, and kapha, which is dampness, combined derangement. From a Western systems analysis, an inflammation of the female genital urinary system. So the object of these diagnoses is they all point to herbal treatment, and they're not just simply a named diagnosis, but they point to the possibility of herbal treatment. So based on that, the herbal treatment that is being recommended is the first one that you see there, dandelion, echinacea, corn silk, abscissola, cleavers, and Irish moss. We thought that was a very rational possible prescription that you might give. Then the tea instructions, again, part of the protocols, telling them how to make things, how to do things, and so forth. Any kind of supplements or lifestyle changes that are necessary to help the individual. And now we're going to go to slide 67, which is Materia Medica. Are you on board with that one out there?
Is it say part three, Materia Medica?
Part three, Materia Medica, yes.
Okay, yes, I am.
Okay, good.
All right, so here's an example of how they took Symphytum officinal, and nice, they even gave the plant family. And they just talked about for it, the energetic of the herb. Now, this is more of a TCM or a Ayurvedic thing, but even in the West, we do talk about herbs being hot or cold and so on. And they talked about, you know, other properties, like it's a vulnerary, that it protects the mucosa of the lungs and the stomach and so on, that it contains, now here's a little bit of the chemical constituent piece, that it's got steroidal saponins, which are anti-inflammatory. That's nice. I always like to see that. Not required by any means, but it's nice. Relieves irritation and provides pain relief and wound healing. There's an action. And then it talks about that there's a lot of controversy around, around Symphytum, of course, because of the PAs. So they didn't say why, but it's nice that they knew it. Personally, I feel that the herb is very effective for acute short-term condition, but should be used with caution. There it is, the PAs. Okay, so that's great. That's an example of how if there is some big, you know, contraindication out there, it's nice that you indicate you know that. And you might agree and you might not. Some people will just say should not use internally. I don't agree with that, but I have to accept it because it's one of the ideas that are out there. I've used comfrey leaf combined with nettles and lemon balm as a tea infusion to relieve the gastric irritation and stomach upset as needed. And that's nice. They give an example of how to use the herb. So this is kind of what we're looking for.
Yeah, it's clear to us that somebody's not just reciting by rote something they got from a book. Yeah, there's a lot of this is in books, but we're getting a flavor of what their concerns are, how they personally approach and use an herb. That's that really says a lot when somebody's responding to Materia Medica. So this is particularly exemplary, I think.
Yes, and I might add, too, that there are a lot of opinions about herbs. There are various styles of dosing. Some people go along with certain contraindications, others don't. And we are open to the fact that there are different viewpoints. So I won't necessarily grade somebody, down because I don't happen to agree with their opinion. As long as it's not a completely cracked opinion, you know what I mean? It has to be based on something.
Yeah, I think the most important thing is that we know that you're dedicated enough to be connected to the informational stream, whether you choose to follow it exactly the way it's presented. That's your own choice, but we're asking for 150 herbs that you're connected to the stream of established knowledge that we know about those herbs. Okay, now we're going to move on to slide 72. Very briefly.
What is slide 72? Is the header on it?
Using formulas and proprietary products.
Okay, I'll find it. Okay.
There we go.
Actually, we skipped ahead, but that's all right. We'll finish this one. Just briefly, there are many proprietary products. For instance, the Ayurveda, a large part of Ayurveda is using established formulas, Googles and Triphalas and Trikatus and different things that are established compounds, Sharavan Phosh. So if you mention these things, you need to spell out to us the ingredients, or at least all or some of the ingredients that are in it, and why you're using it. Not just simply because. So we don't want you to feel that you're just reading the advertiser that the company's putting out as to what that particular formula is good for. Now let's go back to a case study. And here we're going to go to slide number 69.
I can't see the slide number, so you have to tell me what it says header.
Case histories.
Part 4, 3, personal case histories, right?
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah. Got it.
So the woman is age 69, height is 5 feet 10, weight is 123 pounds, and occupation, she's a professional gardener and retired nurse. Primary health concern, severe pain in the first metacarpophalangeal joint of the right thumb and forefinger, which has developed gradually over the years with increased number of gardening jobs. Spring, summer, and fall are the busiest months. She believes all the clipping and snipping has contributed to this. Notice how succinct and yet thorough this presentation is, and how many more words she could have used. Secondary health concerns, some hip pain with less severity and stiffness than hand symptoms. Hip pain increases during and after long walks. Althea, you want to go on with the next one?
Sure.
Number 70. Three personal case histories continued.
So here just saw the physicians in late 2006 regarding the right hand and the hip. Diagnosis was osteoarthritis in both areas. And then that's nice. It tells you what the diagnosis was and then what they did about it and how it worked. Conventional hand treatment, NSAIDs, including naproxen for several months. And then, again, what happened? Well, she felt better, but then she started feeling worse. Then they went on and did corticosteroids, injected into the affected joints. Relief lasted a short time. Once again, what happened? Conventional hip diagnosis and treatment. MRI showed osteoarthritis in the affected area, received corticosteroid injections and physical therapy. Shots helped temporarily, PT did not. So I like this because, again, it's succinct, but they're saying, okay, here's what they looked at, this is what they found, this is what they called it, this is what they did, and this is how it worked out. And that's kind of what you want to see.
Next one. Go ahead. You're doing such a great job out there. Take this one also.
Okay. Observation. Now, this is important for me. I really like these physical assessments. So it tells us a little bit about what the person looked like. Pale complexion, tall, firm, slender build, careful, thoughtful demeanor. And, of course, if you are into energetic medicine, you might add some other things there, too, about eyelids and things like that. But whatever, it's what you observed. She did a good job. Interrogation, meaning questions. The pain increased in cold and damp weather, decreases in warm, humid weather, aggravated by excessive use of hands, joints feel thick and stiff, not numb. Very difficult to lift an object without severe pain. Pain is specific to these joints, does not migrate, limited range of motion. Pain diminishes with rest, does not affect sleep. That's, again, really good. Whenever somebody says pain, I automatically are hoping that you're going to be asking, where is it, how intense, what makes it better, what makes it worse. Perfect. Tongue, here we go, more physical assessments. And these are kind of Chinese medicine things. But there's also looking at tongues even in the Western medicine. Not so pale, really. Pink, thick white coating. The pulse, weak, slow, slippery. Ki and ya, barely detectable at 64 beats per minute. So that's nice. All right.
Another point that I'd like to make here is that I know that each of the different systems of herbal medicine has its own jargon.
Right.
And jargon, I oftentimes think it's just a language that some people learn to hide what they know from other people. Actually, to hide what they don't know. So if somebody says they have damp heat in the lower warmer, or they have qi deficiency or blood deficiency, or any Chinese diagnosis or Ayurvedic diagnosis in terms of the doshas, you should mention those. But we're not, strictly speaking, an Ayurvedic herbal organization or Chinese herbal. We're basically an American herbal organization. And we expect that if you're going to make these statements, I personally am looking for you to demonstrate that you know what you're talking about and find other ways to express it besides in the traditional language. And that brings us to the end of our presentation. And are there any more questions that need to be attended to, Stephen?
There are a few more questions that need to be attended to. Someone asked about... they had tried to apply some years back and were turned down, and wondered if those are kept on file or if they just need to start over again.
When you're talking about years back, yeah, I think you want to start over again.
Okay.
But I don't know that answer to that. I would suggest you call Tracy at the AHG and see what he says.
Okay. There's no. Someone asked about time frame to complete the application. There's no time frame to complete the application. Just when it's completed, send it in. If someone said I've treated many friends and family members, can they include these in as part of their clinical experience?
Absolutely, as long as it's documented.
Okay, and then someone also said, you know, can they? About using these guidelines to develop their educational training program, and that's what we want people to do, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm hoping that that instructors and schools and educational programs will see a value of directing their students to conform, at least on a minimal standard, to the guidelines that we're asking for applicants, and that they direct their students to see the professional certification, the HG, as a kind of final confirmation being the highest level of recognition that anybody who's an herbalist in North America can achieve at this time.
And I might add, if this person is interested, they should contact us, because there are a number of us who are very interested in working toward a council of schools or some sort of networking where, you know, schools can help to grow themselves, and we can really begin to get on the same page about what educational needs in this country are.
I guess the person said that they were told by Tracy that there is a time frame to complete the application. I suppose that might be because periodically there are changes made to the application. So
yes, I think it's 3 months.
Okay. So I guess there is a time frame to complete it. So. But you could,
in some cases, if we think that a student is almost ready, and we just need another year. Then we'll keep their application on file, and then they just supplement the year to their application.
Okay. Someone asked if they're looking for a mentor, how can they go about finding a mentor?
The AHG has a list of mentors, and we will hook people up with them.
Yeah,
I think it's very important that you find a professional clinical herbalist as a mentor, not just anybody, but somebody who actually has experience seeing people. So the AHG has a list and is constantly developing that. I personally feel that this is a great opportunity for schools who are really seriously involved in education to develop mentors out of their own graduates and out of their own faculty, so that it creates another possibility for interaction with the school, because I think it's ideal for a student to find a mentor who's trained in the same training that they're using in their practice.
Someone asked, what are the reputable accredited master degree programs in herbal and complementary field? I know about Thai Sophia and the American College of Healthcare Sciences. Are there others?
I don't quite understand what that question is. Can you frame that again?
I said they're asking about accredited master's degree programs in herbal medicine.
My knowledge, there's only those two, but I'm not positive about that.
Okay.
What accreditation means? I mean, accreditation doesn't necessarily mean that you're licensed.
Oh no, accreditation is a formal thing. You have to be accredited by a regional board. And because it's a master's degree, you would have to be accredited by the Board of Higher Education in the state in which your operation runs, and then you would have to be regionally accredited by the regional accrediting body.
Okay. This is, for those of you who have been asking, being recorded. It will be eventually posted to the AHG site so that you will be able to listen to it. Also, there's a lot of slides that were kind of skipped over in terms of a sample application just for time's sake, and I'm assuming we're going to post the whole thing so they can review the entire sample application to get an idea of what kinds of things you are looking for. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this will be up there for everyone who wants to be able to understand how to do this. And the mentors are available for distance learning. So there are mentors who can work with you wherever you are located. I believe that's everything.
All right.
Wow. Thank you, Michael and Stephen.
Thank you, Althea and Stephen and the AHG for making this possible to do this. And hope to encounter all of you at the next symposium. When and where is it? Or is that important to mention? I think you should look on the website to see what it is. In any case, it's really important. I'm going to be there, and I hope to see many of you there, and hope to see your applications start flooding in, because the more people we have in the organization of professionals, the more we can shape the direction of
Someone did ask if they think it's worth applying even though they're in their seventh decade. Their 70s?
Absolutely.
Go for it.
I'm in my seventh decade, and I would apply, but I don't need to.
All right. Thanks, everyone, and good evening. And the symposium, someone said, is in Pennsylvania.
Oh,
well, how many successful applicants join the professional AHG ranks at AHG every year, approximately?
How many?
About how many on average?
I think we'd have to check that out, but it's immaterial at this point. What's important is that there's at least 234 of you who have been on here, and some of you are signing off. But I hope that at least half of you get working on your application so you see it. All right.
Yeah. All right. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.